Looking for a graduation gift to inform, inspire, and encourage? When you give a subscription to Christianity Today, you're giving redemptive, relevant news and thoughtful, balanced dialogue about the church, current issues, and public theology. Visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to get a discounted student subscription for the graduates in your life. Starting at only $2 per month, this gift will engage and grow their faith throughout the year. Click the link in the show notes or visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to order now.
This episode is brought to you by Our Daily Bread Ministries, a global media organization that makes the life-changing wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to all. Visit whereyourfrom.org for more information. That's whereyafrom.org.
This is CT Media.
Welcome to another episode of Being Human with your host, me, Steve Cuss. Really glad to be with you today. This whole podcast is all about noticing and naming and diffusing anxiety, specifically reactivity. Because reactivity, it does this wild thing where it disconnects us. Oftentimes, we can be reactive and not even know we're reactive. It puts us in conflict with our precious relationships. It stops us from being as aware of God's presence. And so this podcast is all about noticing reactivity so we can relax into God's presence, be more mindful of the God that loves us and relax into the grace of God. Before I bring on my guest today, I just want to start with a quote about Vincent van Gogh, that old painter, Vincent van Gogh. I know most of you probably think his name is Vincent van Gogh, but us Queen saluters, the Commonwealth people, we call him van Gogh. This is a quote describing the miracle of his work. And I'm actually going to put a link in the show notes to a YouTube clip where this quote is, because it's based on a fictional show, Doctor Who, and I won't get too into this, but essentially Doctor Who goes back in time, grabs Vincent van Gogh and brings him into the future, into the 21st century, and takes him to an art museum in England so he can see the impact of his art all these years later. If you know anything about Vincent, he was profoundly broken, very tortured soul, really had no idea if his art would have any impact. And so Doctor Who brings him to the art museum. And not only does he get to see adults and school children swarming over his paintings, but he also gets to overhear the curator of the museum describe Vincent's impact. And that's the quote I'm going to read for you before we light our candle and before I introduce our guests. Here's what the curator said about Vincent van Gogh. He transformed the pain of his tormented life into ecstatic beauty. Pain is easy to portray, but to use your passion and pain to portray the ecstasy and joy and magnificence of our world, no one had ever done it before. Perhaps no one will ever again. And to my mind, that strange wild man who roamed the fields of Provence was not only the world's greatest artist, but also one of the greatest men who had ever lived. And so today we light a candle, just recognizing that it is a real gift to share our pain with each other. I think it's healthier to share our pain than to stuff it. But the great gift too is when we can actually steward our pain and use it to produce beauty. And so in that spirit, we light our candle because we recognize that we serve a God and we are loved by a God that redeems pain, that we are no longer trapped in it. It doesn't get the last word in our life. Sometimes that journey is an incredibly brave journey and a slow journey, but it's still true. I don't say it with any platitude or pithiness that God redeems our pain and can turn beauty out of it. And so in that spirit, I'm going to light our candle and just thank God that God is well acquainted with grief, that God knows our pain, and that God is safe for us to give our pain because he reaches right into it and he redeems it, which doesn't make it go away. It does something much more powerful. It makes us be able to live beautifully in this world. The reason I wanted to read that quote about Van Gogh is that's the quote that reminds me of my guests today. Today, I got to chat with Charlie Peacock and his wife, Andy Ashworth. They are two remarkable human beings. They recently released a book. We get into their book. I've got a link to that in the show notes. And the book really is a testimony to the beauty of their art that was forged out of tremendous pain and trauma. There's so much I love about Charlie and Andy. I moved to America in 1992. I didn't know anyone. I started Bible college. It was a great adventure, but I was also profoundly lonely. And Charlie's music was a real balm for me because every time he produces music, whether he's singing or playing piano or oftentimes behind the mixing board where there's someone else as the artist and Charlie is the producer, it's just beautiful. So I've been moved by Charlie's work for a long time, but also Andy as well. In the 1990s, Charlie and Andy did this radical thing that no one was really doing. They bought an old church and they converted it. They called it the Art House. And they worked out of that. They lived in that. They raised their kids in that place. But Charlie produced music. They hosted seminars. And Andy did untold amounts of hospitality, where it became like this epicenter in Nashville of an expression of art that was done in the name of Jesus, but also very much in the public space. And so the Art House really moved me when I was in my 20s in the 1990s. I followed the work of Charlie and Andy very closely. And I began the interview just asking Andy what it was like to practice so much hospitality in the Art House, what it was like when she was starting to get weary. How did she know it was time to wrap it up?
Boy, Steve, I was so tired by then. I was in my late 50s, not quite 60, as we were trying to decide what are we going to do. I could bring the energy when I needed to, but my mind and my heart really needed to respond to my aging body. I wanted to respond to my writing. And so it was really hard because the place itself was something we loved so much. We had created it together, both of us in different ways. And we really, truly did love every knob on the cupboards. And I had created gardens there over 20 years and just so many things. We had so many memories of family life there. So there was a lot to grieve, but it was also, I couldn't imagine continuing on past the age I was at and into my 60s and continuing to do the really hard, constant work of living in an open home as we had been.
Yeah, I remember I was in college. I hate to be the young kid on this interview,
that's
but
all right,
I was
you
in
are.
College and I was so animated by the vision of the Art House. Charlie, it really started, I think, in your head. Obviously, mm-hmm. It was a ministry of both of yours, but what was your hope for that place when you first got it going?
Yeah, it really took root, I would say, when I was touring in Europe. And I can remember sitting on the big expanse of grass at the Greenbelt Festival in the UK. And I had my journal and I was talking with a friend and explaining to him this idea that was developing of a place in Nashville where we would really try to sort out what it meant to be a disciple and to be an artist. And part of that was me wanting to explore that in the context of Nashville and contemporary Christian music, because once we had moved to Nashville, I realized, oh, wow, a lot of these folks really take this thing seriously. Like, this is the highest and best expression of music, right? As disciples of Jesus. And I just did not believe that. I didn't have anything against it. I was obviously came there to participate in it, and I was grateful for the work and I loved the people that I was working around. But theologically, I was like, oh no, no. The whole relationship between God and music is a very, very long story, multi-generational, multi-ethnic, involves every place in the world. not to mention the music of the heavens. And so I just was like, no, we have to think much bigger than this. I don't want to denigrate this, but I want to say that it's just a drop in a glass, you know, of possibilities. So that was the original inspiration from it. We came home from that, talked to Andy about it, talked to our then pastor, Scotty Smith, and he had been a Francis Schaefferite, Edith Schaefer follower since he was in his late teens, early 20s. So he got the idea immediately. We didn't want to be a residential place, but we wanted to find somewhere that could be a magnetic gathering place. And it just so happened that when I first came to Nashville, I used to drive by this place every day. And then when we moved there, one day we were driving by what is effectively or had been a Methodist church that was founded in 1912. Later, that church moved down the road, built a new facility, and that place became a kind of bed and breakfast, and some people moved in. They had their home there. And I looked at it, and I was like, that's it. You know, that could maybe be the art house. It was first an idea and then a place, and those were combined. And then we knew that we had a mutual calling to it. We had an experience together that we felt confirmed something was happening that we couldn't necessarily articulate, but we knew that God was inviting us into something that he had already, in a sense, created.
Yeah, and so it was this one-stop shop, like you're raising your family there. Charlie, your music studio was there.
That's right.
You guys hosted not just seminars and workshops, but guests.
Yeah.
And so, Andy, back to you on hospitality. You know, you hear the vision of something like Art House and the hospitality involved, but you wrote really poignantly in the book about the reality of the hospitality, guests that outstayed their welcome, that wouldn't pick up their own dishes, the power of a frittata to feed a crowd. Tell us about just the wonderful side and the taxing side of all of that.
Yeah. I didn't, when I was young, ever set out to say, I want to live sometime in an old church and have hundreds and hundreds of people coming and going all the time. But it is something that was, as I was called to God in my late 20s, then eventually there was this slow work going on in me and in the two of us and in the places. So it was something that I learned to love. Because I love people, I love relationships, I found that I had this ability to sit with people and talk for long periods of time. And I really, really liked that. Was such a sweet spot for me. Imagining menus, creating food was a sweet spot. And it was also a whole lot of work, changing beds and cleaning bathrooms and all of that stuff put together. So that both had just really great joy that was part of it. And I felt that it was such a privilege to hear people's stories and to also carry them in my heart and in my prayers. And then there was this other part that really got hard. We really didn't set out in the beginning to have boundaries. We did not live with privacy. We kept trying to find ways to have a sustainable vocation. We never really totally fully arrived. We're not arrived right now either. But in that setting, we tried. But I wrote about it later in life looking back and thought, well, if I were beginning again something on the front end, I would set up a real commitment to Sabbath, to having one day out of seven, to actually really fully rest, cease worry, cease work, have a playful, very other kind of day to look forward to every week. And sometimes I would want to build in some actual sabbatical. And then the self-care part, that you do need to have care for yourself and whatever that looks like in an individual life so that you can give out and be with people and care for them. So those things, if I were starting over again, would be essential. But I didn't know that starting out. Neither one of us did.
And I was intentionally working against Andy's agenda and her hope and dream, because we had two different ways of dealing with our brokenness. My self-care was work. I had to stay moving. So in many ways, we had opposite, unarticulated agendas early on during all of that.
Yeah, the book is such a beautiful weaving. You guys generally take a chapter each, you know, one chapter then the other. Obviously, occasionally one of you did a couple of chapters in a row. What really struck me as I read it was you gave us a hint at the beginning. There's trauma here.
Yeah.
Andy, you referenced it related to your mom and her mom and cooking. Charlie, you referenced it. But then somewhere about midway through the book, as you're giving us visions of hospitality in the art house and living publicly and doing public art, and what does it mean to do Christian art? Is that even a thing? You give us all of that. But then the book really, to me, starts to get right down to the rubber. Charlie, for example, I believe it was 2016, I might have the year wrong, where your body just started failing you. And as you were just saying then, my coping mechanism was to produce. You were this extremely highly productive person. You had this engine inside that just went until suddenly it didn't. Just tell us a bit about what that was like. You went through a few months of a constant headache and you had to get some tests and take it from there.
I was really in the best shape of my life. I created a commercial music program at a local university and was the head of the School of Music. And we had moved from the art house to closer downtown Nashville near this university. And I just really imagined a completely different life than the one that emerged. And the one that emerged was that I was not in control anymore. Living at the art house and having everything there, people always coming to us, controlling all the events, the studio time, the artists, the guests, all of that was completely flipped on its head. And I entered into, you know, one of the most baffling environments that that one could enter into, which is an American university, where you think education is at the forefront, and it's certainly there, but fundraising is really at the forefront. And for me, because I had some quasi-celebrity, you know, that meant that I was always pushed forward to be an advocate for the university. So that and some other issues led to me having this neurological breakdown, which manifests itself in a headache that I woke up to one morning and I still have to this day, 7+ years later. I'm demonstrably healthier than I was mentally, spiritually. Sadly to say, not as much physically, but nevertheless, yeah, that was a huge, huge change. And it was so much about I had constructed a world because I had the privilege of it and the resources to construct a world in which life would work for me in light of my brokenness. And once I moved outside of that space into this uncontrollable world, things just quickly came undone.
Yeah, it's a common story, I think, isn't it? That particularly when you're carrying trauma or trauma has a hold of you, you don't even know you're doing everything you can to keep it in a lockbox.
That's right.
And then suddenly it shows up like uninvited. Charlie, you wrote one of the most poignant chapters I've ever read in my life about your relationship with your dad. You laid out for us this physical journey, going to the Mayo Clinic. And then after you laid that out for us, you laid out the complexity of a son's relationship with his father. I remember, I think I was a sophomore in college when your song, My Father's Crown, came out.
That's right.
And the chapter that you wrote reminded me of that song. That song was such a palpable cry.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear what you're thinking about that.
Yeah. Well, today, my relationship with my father, who has been passed away 30+ years ago, we have a great relationship. So much forgiveness, so much healing. I wish he were here to feel what I feel. How I see him now in all the stages of life. I don't see him just as my dad, an older man, but I see him as a child. I see him as a teenager. I see him as entering into the Air Force band. I see him as his first teaching job at a high school. I see him writing his own music. I see his disappointments. I see him interacting with his father and his father not seeing him. So I have a completely different view of my father than I did during all the times that we butted heads. I was the best music student that my dad ever had. Part of that is because of him. He treated me in a way that I could not understand. He gave me enough deference and respect to treat me like an adult, but my 13-year-old mind was not ready for that. I rarely received like, wow, that was amazing. You know, it was always like, yeah, that's good. And now, and now let's get to fixing it, repairing it, and bringing it to him, to what is the competitive level. And no, by the way, son, if you don't reach this competitive level, you'll never amount to anything. And so that was the driver for my entire adult life.
Yeah. And Andy, you guys have been together since you were 15, 16, mm-hmm. married at 18 and 19. It's mind-blowing to think about all that you've walked through together. You wrote in the book, Andy, I've got a quote here. You said, have you ever been in that place, dear reader, whether a year into your marriage or 5 years or 40, where you don't feel like yourselves? Mm-hmm. And of course, Charlie is going on his own journey, but it's absolutely leaking out toward you with the way he starts treating you as he's navigating his anger and giving himself permission to chase things. You've got your own journey and your own story. What was that like for you, that beginning? I know you guys are still in that era, but the beginning of that era 7 years ago.
Oh boy, it was pretty awful. Mysterious is a way of saying it. I couldn't understand. I wished that somebody was outside of us was coming in and saying, calm down, this is what's happening, and giving kind of a name, helping us through. Thankfully, I had a really great therapist that I was already seeing. And even she was saying, you know, I'm really good at figuring things out, but I can't really figure out what's going on here. And then she sent us to a couples therapist. That very gifted person was somebody who really began to take a chisel and get in there and help us to talk. And even that was really hard. And sometimes we would just leave her office and we'd go, we can't go back again. It's too painful. We'd come home, we'd have another fight, or we'd have something we just weren't getting through to each other. On the one hand, all of that was going on. On the other hand, because I was with a very good therapist, I was actually in some ways in a good place in the midst of it all. And I was beginning to see that I had needs that I wasn't very good at naming or assessing. So really sitting and beginning to say, it is very human and right and God-given to have needs. It's legitimate. And what are those? And so with my therapist, I began to really think about that question, because it felt like, really, can I think about that right now? My husband is so sick and our house is in such turmoil, but it was actually a really good thing to do. So I thought about everything from, you know, very personal things to, I want to have a life going forward where we're both making choices together about what we want our life to look like. I want a more playful life where we are championing each other, but we also have other things like, can we play a game of Scrabble sometimes? Can we have a more intentional life towards peer friendships, people that are just our age that we just want to be with because they're our friends? You know, many things like that. So I was kind of in both those places, both very hurt and very confused and trying to understand, trying to own my own part. There was that. And then the trying to say first to myself, these are the needs. These are things I want. These are legitimate and good. And then to be able to communicate them to Chuck, and which I did in writing. So that time was a beginning of another stage of our life that we are still in, but we are definitely further, way further down the road than we were 8 years ago, with so much more understanding of each other, kindness and forgiveness, and being quicker to say, I see what I just did. Will you forgive me? I see what I just said. Will you forgive me?
We had to start over again with, in a sense, our Christian life and our marriage, because we were so grateful when we came to Christ, and particularly the time that we came to in the early 1980s. The ethos of the time with the Christian communities that we were in was like, the Lord has just cast that as far as the East is from the West, you know, and all of that's in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all glory going forward and love and peace. But we didn't do the work that needed to be done. You know, neither of us could have known that for me, that there was a 14 to 16 year old teenager in me that needed to just completely lose it. And never did, because they were a hypervigilant survivor. Mm-hmm. There just simply was not time to lose it. And I remember when I started seeing a therapist around the time when the headache started, one of the riffs for me, I think a lot was like, you know, I can't stand, it's like everybody around me, they get to just completely fall apart. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't get to fall apart. How come I don't ever get to fall apart? It's like I see these people all the time saying, oh, I just can't do that. I can't do, you know, and I'd be going on and on like that. And then the therapist would say, like, well, what's keeping you from just letting yourself fall apart? What do you think will happen if you just let go? And of course, I knew what would happen. I knew that I would have to face all of this stuff, that I would have to face my anger that other people could clearly see while I was doing this sort of chilled out Charlie thing. And so that was the need that I had, was to finally express all of that and to also come to terms. I mean, we both have suffered physical and sexual abuse. There's just a lot of trauma issues that we had to just like name them and say them out loud again. And like, I know, I think we talked about this, but if we didn't, bam, you know, and each one of those bams was just like a bomb going off. And for me, I mean, I really lost it in a lot of ways about some very, very important, deeply hurtful things. And we had to get through all of that. And the irony of it is up until that time, I can't tell you how many people we've sat and talked to about saying, look, it's going to get worse before it gets better. You know, I mean, we've said that to people so many times. And oh my gosh, we had to sip our own medicine. But when it got better, it was the best. And it still is the best.
This episode is brought to you by the Truce Podcast. I'm sure you've been there. You're at an event, a dinner, a small group, and someone says something like,
if you're a Christian, you have to vote Republican.
Huh. That raises an interesting question. How did evangelicals like me get to the place where we just assumed we'd all vote one way? This season on the Truce Podcast, we're diving deep into the complexity of the 1970s and 80s to understand how evangelicals tied themselves to the Republican Party. It's a story that involves murder, corruption, redemption, and our need to be heard. I'll be talking with celebrated historians like Rick Perlstein, Pulitzer Prize winners Francis Fitzgerald and Jesse Eisinger, and some of the best guests I've ever had. Truce is the show that uses journalistic tools to look inside the Christian church. We press pause on the culture wars in order to explore how we got here and how we can do better. Subscribe to Truce anywhere you get podcasts or listen at trucepodcast.com.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m., we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
You know, Charlie, you were on the forefront of the expression of Christian music in the 90s, where there were all these genres and all this budget. And I think of the comedian Nate Bargatze in your own hometown there. He says the 80s and 90s Christians were the most Christian. Yeah. But yeah. By which he means what you were saying, like just Jesus took it away. What's the problem? Let's get on with it.
Yeah.
What I love about both of your story is the way you've given yourselves permission and each other permission to be human, to spend your 60s in this new era of curiosity and discovery and pain. Mm. To me, I've got a couple of thoughts that hopefully will form a question. The first one is, I think some people steward their pain and their output, their writing or their music comes out in pain. But you guys have also brought your pain out in great joy and beauty. Mm. I don't know if that was intentional or just the redemption of God or some combination, but I'd love to get your reaction to that.
If that's what's happening, then I say, thank you, Lord. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I do think that we have really felt the combination of those things, the joy and the pain, for many years. So there was, both whatever we were feeling inside, whatever we were in together, whatever all the tensions in the midst of it, and then a serious gratitude for also people that were in our lives, for our children, for our family. We have had a lot of joy in our family life doing intentional things that we're just saying, we want to make memories together, we want to do things that are joyful and fun. And I think in all of those ways, we've had this great combination, and I'm glad that comes through.
Well, and as I was chatting with you guys before we recorded, I have been a massive appreciator of your work since the early 90s. I moved to the United States in 1992. I didn't know a soul, and music was a huge part of my comfort when I was profoundly homesick for Australia. Mm-hmm. And Charlie, your music was a huge part for me. And it's interesting, when I read your book, one of your last chapters was quite reflective about the regret of the impact on Andy that your ambition had, the impact on your kids. And But as somebody who's followed your work since the 90s, it feels like the two of you have always put beauty into the world in a unique and complex way. Mm. I don't know if that's helpful to hear from a fan or a person who's received your work, but for me, it's only ever been fresh, beautiful, arresting, very thoughtful and integrated. And never that polished Christianese cheerful, like that anxious cheerfulness is what I would call it. Yeah. The anxious need to be cheerful. It's always been quite integrated.
I'm so glad.
I mean, I think I had the benefit of prior to following Christ and really understanding the gospel for the first time, I already understood something about what it meant to be an artist. And so I came to faith as an artist. I didn't come to faith and then think like, oh, well, art would be a great thing to use for the gospel. I didn't know anything other than a making or maker culture. And so my models for that were also rigorously truthful. They weren't necessarily what we would call by genre standards Christian artists. But when I was a kid and I was listening to Jackson Browne or Paul Simon or Joni Mitchell, these were people who were singing real life narratives of like, I did this, they did this, we did this. And they told those stories and they didn't edit out the parts that were less flattering. You let the reader sort it out, but you tell the whole story. And so that sort of confessional art making was at the heart of who I was as a young artist. And I brought that into following Christ.
Yeah. And Andy, your public contribution is writing. You know, I know you went to seminary and did some theology, but you're also in the school of fine writing, Lucy Shaw, that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, talk to me about that. I mean, writing in many ways is completely at odds with hospitality. And in other ways, I guess it benefits, but...
Yeah, yes. There was so much tension between those two things, particularly in our art house years. Because I was writing through most of those years and writing for deadlines and wanting to develop, having ideas, wanting to develop things. But then if somebody shows up at your door, you're going to turn to that person if that is your vocation as well. So I had these two really major parts, the hospitality part, the writing part of me, and I would kind of turn back and forth between the two. And sometimes the writing would have to take a back seat for weeks at a time, months at a time, for so many reasons, but all having to do with people. But I still was always writing, and that's the thing. I've been writing since I was a little girl, writing in little diaries. It's that journaling, diary writing part of me that's always the through line over really most of my life, including right now. I do always have a date with myself on most Saturday mornings to write in my journal. And that is more of a kind of an archiving, kind of a reflection. And that fulfills a really deep need in me. And so that one thing, even through the most crowded times of our public life in the art house of having this very open home, if I could do that one thing pretty regularly, and that would help. But I do recognize that even if I only have a small kind of hidden way to do it, that's okay. There will be times to do it more publicly, but the more private part is what's going to keep me going. And
Steve, Andy has come up with this genius idea that people like me would do well to receive, and it's that not every creative act needs to be monetized.
Gosh,
what a gift to our family, because I can literally, we're in her office right now. I could reach up here in a cupboard right now. There's about 60 of her journals up there. And I could go to 1991 and scroll through there and find out, oh, that was the date that I was in the studio and she brought the kids over and visited, and we were working on this album. So that's how much detail is in there. And it's always available to us in the family to be able to find our life again. Like, oh yeah, we did that together. That's amazing.
Well, Andy and Charlie, you've hatched plans with Bono to address the global AIDS crisis. You've played music with the world's finest jazz bass player, John Patitucci. However, you have not yet endured the gauntlet of anxiety questions that we do here on the Being Human.
All right, here we go.
I'm going to ask you to brace yourself like a man and a woman.
Okay. I love it.
Five questions, rapid fire style. So feel free just to give quick answers, even though it's kind of unfair. They're deep questions, but Here's the first one. What are the early signs in you that you're emotionally dysregulated?
I'm looping on a particular thing. There's a thought, there's an event, there's a conversation, and my mind is just going round and round and round and round.
Yeah. Charlie?
Yeah. Quick to anger, snippy. The neurosymptoms are really aggravated. I'll get a lot of hyperacusis stuff with my ears, a lot of trembling. The headache gets worse. I just feel it in my body, and then I start to manifest it in a real lack of patience.
Okay. My field is reactivity. It's a unique form of anxiety because it's contagious. It's the only anxiety that's actually contagious, but also because it's generated by a false need as opposed to trauma that is generated by a real thing that happened to you. So for example, for me, one source of reactivity would be if I'm misunderstood. I have a false need for someone to understand me, and therefore I use incessant words if somebody's misunderstanding me.
Boy.
What would be something that you think you need that you don't actually need?
I would jump on with you on that. If I'm misunderstood or disrespect, I would also put disrespected in there because I haven't been clearly understood. Then I feel like it's my job to like talk and talk and talk until we end up to a place where we're in agreement that A equals B, right? I don't really need that, but boy, everything in my brain tells me I cannot be at peace until I get that.
Yeah, it's a great answer.
And I guess in company with that, when he's feeling like that, what I think I need and what I think might be a real need is I need to back out. I need space. I need to slow down. I need to not have so many words because it just freezes me. But then sometimes it's a really important thing to stay in the conversation. So I have those two things. I want to flee, and I also need to find a way to stay in the conversation. But maybe sometimes I do need to just go in the other room and say, give me 5, give me 10, give me some processing time.
It's actually a really important question, Andy, because as I hear you answer that, and you know, the gauntlet is cruel, I'm putting you on the spot with these deep questions, but that sounds like it's probably a true need. When I'm doing organizational work, I make everyone tell me, are you a rapid processor or a deliberate processor? How fast does your brain move? Are you an external communicator or internal? And quite often in marriage, they're opposites. And therefore, you know, one is moving quickly using more words, one is moving slowly using less, and it's hard to stay connected. Let me throw this question at you. There's character traits in people that just drive us crazy. For me, one would be courtesy. If you're discourteous, so when I'm flying, I travel a lot, and someone's trying to get ahead of us on the plane to get off the plane, oh, it just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
What would be a character trait in someone that irritates you?
Somebody who monopolizes a conversation rather than has the skill of a back and forth that you can both show up and tell your story to each other, get to know each other better, or upon first meeting or upon subsequent meetings?
Yeah, it's not listening or not reading in a communication. That really tips the scales for me. The other side of that is not being able to say, I did something wrong or I'm sorry. That also drives me crazy.
Okay, very good. Next one's a fill in the blank. What if I were as blank to myself as God is? For me, it's probably kind. What if I were as kind to myself as God is?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. I was feeling the same exact word.
Kind, loving, and present.
Okay.
Yeah, are what I need to.
You guys have sailed through the gauntlet. The final question, when recently in your life have you felt most fully and completely loved?
Well, on Tuesday night, just a couple nights ago, we had a book launch at our local bookstore, Parnassus Books. And I had been anxious and fearful about that for months in the way of thinking, well, what if we show up and nobody else shows up? What if we throw a party and nobody comes? And it turned out to be just the opposite. We had a full house and I felt so much love from our community. And then afterwards we came home, our children had cooked and baked and created an after celebration for us. So that whole, those two things together were just like, there's nothing I can do but receive that mm-hmm. as great love. I still haven't processed it at all yet because we've kind of, you know, been moving from one thing to the next, but I really do want to sit with all that and take it in. And there was so much joy and God was very obviously present and pouring out in all these ways through all these people.
Andy, but Charlie, before we get to your answer, yeah. Andy, I love that your answer was essentially you were the recipient of others' hospitality. Mm. With everything that you've poured out for decades, what a beautiful answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right, Charlie, what have you got for us?
Yeah, I do want to add one thing that was especially poignant and moving. A couple who are 10 years older than us, whom we love and respect immensely, got on an airplane in Seattle and flew to Nashville. And when we were sitting there ready to start our reading and go into the Q&A and all of that, we turned to our right and they're sitting there on a bench. And I, as soon as we were done, I ran up to them and hugged them and said, "What in the world? Did you just happen to be in Nashville this week or what's going on?" And they said, "No. We saw that you were having this event and we just said, let's just get on a plane and go there." Man, that was such a gift.
Mm. Friends, my guests are Andy Ashworth and Charlie Peacock. They're on the show right now for a number of reasons, but most notably their book that just came out together, Why Everything That Doesn't Matter Matters So Much, The Way of Love in a World of Hurt. I'll have a link to that book in the show notes. I'm also going to be linking Charlie's podcast on Christianity Today, which is just a wonderful journey of the history of music and art. But one of Charlie's recent episodes where he hosted a Grammys review with some other artists and producers that was really captivating. I'll also be linking Andy's previous book and just a couple of songs that have meant a lot to me over the years that Charlie's put out into the world. One where he's in front of the microphone and one where he's at the mixing desk. Charlie and Andy, what a pleasure this has been. Thank you so much for your work in the world. Thanks for joining me on Being Human.
Thank you, Steve. Such a great conversation.
Being Human is a production of Christianity Today. It's executive produced by Eric Petrick and Mike Cosper. It's produced and edited by Matt Stevens. The associate producers are Mackenzie Hill and Ray Gilliam, with music by Dan Phelps, mix engineer Kevin Morris, and graphic design by Amy Jones.
Every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear. Jesus transforms, CT equips. Make a gift to our nonprofit ministry with a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.